I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. On Thursday, President Biden held a press conference on the quickly spreading Omicron variant that's now been found in multiple states.
We knew there'd be cases of Omicron here in the United States, and it's here. But we have the best tools, the best vaccines in the world, and the best medicine, and the best scientists in the world. We're going to fight this variant with science and speed, not chaos and confusion. Just like we beat back COVID-19 in the spring and more powerful variant, Delta variant, in the summer and fall.
So to mount that fight, Biden has a new plan. No lockdowns. Instead, the White House wants to focus on vaccinating families, getting every adult a booster shot, and upping the testing on international travelers. The administration is even pushing for free at-home COVID tests covered by private insurance. Tom from Massachusetts called The Takeaway to tell us that whatever Biden's doing, he believes it.
The Biden administration has been 100% honest in its approach to the COVID pandemic, unlike the Trump administration, which was all politics. Joe Biden has led by example. They follow the science, and I have complete trust and faith in all actions they take.
Another caller, who has an immunocompromised daughter, explained how Biden's approach has actually made things more reassuring, particularly compared with the previous administration.
I give Biden high marks for his taking care of the pandemic. I think why we have so many problems right here in the U.S., of course, variants from around the world, but the unvaccinated here, I blame, and I'm mad about it, that they will not get vaccinated. I have a daughter who's immunocompromised with a transplant, and I feel that they are risking her life.
Biden said that to beat the new variant, it's time for Americans to be united.
We move forward in the face of COVID-19 and the Delta variant, and we'll move forward in the face of Omicron variant as well. And we'll do it by keeping the faith and doing it together as the United States of America.
But unlike some of our listeners, Americans across the country aren't entirely united in their support of the president. Despite getting positive marks from a good number of our listeners, that hasn't been translating into the president's approval ratings, which right now sit at about 42%. The latest Morning Consult poll to come out found that 52% of voters disapprove of the job he's doing this year. Now, don't forget, Build Back Better, his signature piece of legislation, passed the House, and his approval rating still hasn't budged. And when it comes to getting the shot, less than 60% of Americans are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, one of the lowest rates among wealthy nations. So what does all of this mean for the White House when it comes to their response against Omicron? Joining us to discuss this is Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Washington correspondent covering health policy at the New York Times. Cheryl, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the Omicron variant has been found here in the U.S. What do we know about it?
Well, it has been found in multiple states in the U.S. There's still a lot that we don't know. We know that this variant is more transmissible than past variants, but what we don't know is whether it evades the vaccines and how severe the disease is that it causes. There are some indications based on the mutations of the variant that it is likely to evade vaccines, and that's what officials are really concerned about. They're also concerned about the speed at which Omicron replicates and infects others.
You know, I was thinking about President Reagan and the air traffic controllers strike and the sort of the political science or politics rule that you just don't have an air traffic control strike at Christmas. You do not do that, right? Like, don't disrupt the things that make the holiday season in particular important to Americans. And I was wondering, like, if at the White House, as Omicron was being announced here right during the Thanksgiving holiday season, if there was a sense of, oh my gosh, we've done a pretty good job of controlling and bringing down infections and deaths, but Omicron brings back that anxiety, like regardless of what happens with its actual mortality rates, it just brings back that stress and anxiety right at the holidays.
Yes, although I think, frankly, there's already a level of stress and anxiety at the White House over the Delta surge. It is true that the deaths and hospitalizations took a big dip during the first half of this year. But during the second half of this year, we've seen those hospitalizations and deaths climb even before Omicron arrived, and that's due to Delta. So I think the White House was already kind of on pretty high alert for the holiday season, and we would have seen the president announce a winter COVID strategy, I think, even absent the arrival of the Omicron variant.
When you talk about announcing a strategy, this is perhaps the president's great challenge, is this capacity to gain trust, right? As he talks about being the United States of America. And yet we see the divisions that became even more readily apparent, I think, for ordinary observers during the Trump administration. But they have not gone away under President Biden. We do see very, very strong indications of distrust around the vaccines. I'm wondering if there is a particular strategy for actually building that trust.
Well, I think the White House is trying. You do see incredible divisions. If you look at approval ratings of the president based on his coronavirus response by party, you will see that Americans are absolutely divided. Around 47% approve of his handling of the pandemic and around 47% disapprove. And the ones who approve are almost exclusively Democrats, and the ones who disapprove are almost exclusively Republicans. And I think that those divisions have made it really complicated for the president to address an already challenging crisis. One thing we noticed when he announced his vaccine strategy or his pandemic strategy is that it steers away from some of those things that are very divisive. He took pains to note that he is not imposing any additional vaccine mandates. There are not going to be any lockdowns. And he pretty much steered clear of talking about mask mandates, with the exception of saying that he was going to extend the existing mask mandates in airports and bus stations and train stations and on all forms of transit through mid-March.
I'm wondering if even as the president, the White House, the federal administration is saying we're not going to put in place these mandates, if they're on the phone in the back rooms, if they're calling states and governors, at least certainly in their own party, to urge them, at least at the statewide level, to do so.
Honestly, I don't think they are. And there's a reason for that. A lot of these governors now have their hands tied by their legislatures. I was talking to an infectious disease expert in Minnesota yesterday, and he said that the governor there really can't impose a mask mandate because the legislature won't allow it. Right now, only six states have mask mandates for people or require mask wearing indoors for people who are both vaccinated and unvaccinated. Another three states have mandates for those who are unvaccinated. But last year in 2020, there were 43 states that had mask mandates. So we have seen that aspect of the response has been pretty much abandoned at the state level.
It's an interesting counterpoint to many of our European allies who are, in fact, creating at least lockdowns and quarantine rules for the unvaccinated. We've seen this now in several European nation states. I'm presuming that is just a strategy that absolutely would not move forward in the U.S.?
I would have a very hard time seeing that move forward in the U.S. I just think that would be equivalent to the Biden lose the election campaign. I mean, I just don't see that happening.
So given that the president is interested in vaccinations and particularly moving towards vaccinations for families, do you have a sense of how they're talking about sort of campaigns to move whole families, you know, into the column of being willing to be vaccinated without these kinds of mandates?
Well, they're talking about new family vaccination clinics, places where, as the president said, the whole family can come and, you know, get vaccinated together and a place where, you know, a trusted setting where they can get counseling and have their concerns addressed. They're even talking about mobile vaccination sites. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is going to start deploying these family mobile vaccination clinics in the state of Washington and New Mexico. And the goal is for states and localities to kind of replicate that model with federal funding and support. I think the administration recognizes that there's some core of the American public that they are just never going to reach, these sort of hardcore anti-vaxxers. But they still think that there is a group that is movable, that is persuadable. And they are going to try to do that through education campaigns, through these clinics, by making it easier for people to both get vaccinated and boosted. The AARP is pitching in, and they're going to be offering rides to vaccination centers. So I think this is kind of, you know, just an all-out effort to get whoever they can persuade to get vaccinated, to get those shots. And there is some evidence that people are concerned enough now about Omicron that those who are unvaccinated maybe are going to change their minds and get vaccinated.
Whatever is going to happen with Omicron, it does seem that the president is not going to have to worry about a government shutdown at the holidays. Talk to me about that a bit.
Well, Republicans on Capitol Hill had been threatening to shut down the government over the vaccine mandates. But overnight, in kind of a surprise, they dropped that opposition. And the Senate has already taken up the House bill to avert a government shutdown.
I'm wondering if you're surprised where the president's approval ratings are right now, given that he moved the big infrastructure bill, that he's at least got Build Back Better through the House of Representatives, that, as you pointed out, numbers and hospitalizations and deaths did come down, even if there's been a bit of a rebound of them in the winter. Are you surprised that the president is down below 50?
Not entirely. I just think that the country is so divided, and you know, there are always going to be some people who are on the fence. So you've got a split nation. Republicans are just never going to give Joe Biden their approval. You've got the majority of Democrats giving him their approval. But then you've got those swing voters who are in the middle who go back and forth. I would add one other thing, that the economy is actually showing healthy job gains. And that usually would help a president in approval ratings. And I'm going to be interested to see, you know, how the economy does. Really, if you remember what Bill Clinton said, they said, it's the economy, stupid. And when it comes down to it, the economy is always a major driver of presidential approval ratings. Biden has inflation to worry about, but like I said, jobs are looking pretty good. So I think coming around to the end of the year, we'll see how that affects his standing with the American public.
That war room insight that just lives on. It's the economy, stupid. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Washington correspondent covering health policy at the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway with Melissa Harris-Perry from WNYC and PRX in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
On Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. The case centers on a Mississippi law which indisputably violates a 50-year constitutional precedent established in Roe v. Wade. By restricting abortion at 15 weeks, well before the viability of a fetus, the only way the court can uphold the Mississippi statute is by reversing or meaningfully altering the 1973 decision that asserted Americans have a right to an abortion. Now, to be clear, there are multiple frameworks for considering abortion. I mean, first, there is abortion as a personal consultation of capacity, conscience, and desire that a pregnant person has within themselves. and 60% of people who have abortions are already parents, people with a clear understanding of the realities of pregnancy and parenting. Also, there is abortion as a medical discussion of risk and health that a pregnant person may have with their doctor. The CDC reports that just over 750 women died from complications related to childbirth in the United States in 2019. So the risks of pregnancy are neither theoretical nor remote. And of course, there is religious conversation among those who share faith claims about whether abortion is allowed or prohibited. The Pew Research Center finds considerable debate among people of faith, and Pew data show that a majority of Americans in every major religious denomination, including Catholics, believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases. Only white evangelicals disagree, with more than three quarters believing abortion should be illegal in most or all cases. But while personal, medical, and religious claims are all meaningful, appropriate, and robust locations for discussion of abortion, right now, the decision about whether or not pregnant people have a right to terminate a pregnancy is not going to be decided in any of those spaces. The right to abortion is in the hands of nine individuals who will decide based on their understanding and interpretations of the Constitution. A fraught but foundational document. And because it's the court that will decide, many of the jurisprudential discussions will be conducted on terms wholly alien to ordinary citizens whose lives will be shaped by the outcomes. So as the Takeaway seeks to understand this particular moment in our national history, we wanted to delve into the competing legal theories and constitutional claims that are guiding this decision. We spoke with Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, and Carter Sneed, professor of law at Notre Dame University. We focused on the 14th Amendment, which lies at the core of Roe v. Wade. Passed by Congress in 1866 and ratified in 1868, the 14th Amendment establishes a definition of citizenship and articulates the unabridged rights of citizens to due process and equal protection. Elizabeth Wydra started us off.
So it really gets to the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equality, liberty, and equal citizenship stature. And in the context of abortion specifically, the question when it comes to the constitutional protections under the 14th Amendment as it relates to abortion is whether one can enjoy that equal citizenship stature that's promised in the amendment if one cannot make such a personal decision as whether or not to have a child, a decision that is so central to charting one's own destiny and making one's own choices about one's body.
She went on to explain the historical context of the 14th Amendment.
And the question really that the 14th Amendment was designed to answer is, what does it mean to be free? What does it mean to be equal? And the drafters of the 14th Amendment were specifically responding to the horrors of slavery and were looking at the ways in which rights and liberties were denied to enslaved people. And in the joint report that was used to draft the language of the 14th Amendment, they specifically talked about the brutal hallmarks of slavery, primarily the denial of rights over one's own body, to make decisions about one's own body and to have personal security and bodily integrity, and the denial of rights of family and reproductive liberty, something that was brutally denied to enslaved women during that period, and something that the drafters of the 14th Amendment were keenly concerned about protecting in the 14th Amendment. And so that type of concern, the idea that in order to be a free person, in order to step onto the public square as an equal, you need to have those rights of bodily integrity and personal liberty, that's deeply embedded into the 14th Amendment. Now, of course, it's not in the text, but the 14th Amendment is not intended to be a laundry list of rights. They specifically wrote in broad terms, words like equal protection, words like due process, words like liberty, privileges or immunities of citizenship. But behind that language, if you read the history, it's clear that these rights of bodily integrity and personal reproductive liberty were included in that concept of what it means to be a free person. And that question echoes today. and echoed through the halls of the Supreme Court when we heard arguments about whether or not women would be allowed to make these decisions for themselves about their own bodies and their own destinies, in the year 2021.
Professor Sneed introduced a very different way to understand the core values of equal protection at stake in the abortion question and offered an alternate reading of the historical context of the 14th Amendment.
The reason the issue is so vexed and controversial is because there are contending incommensurable goods that are at issue here, namely the good of defending the intrinsic equal dignity of prenatal human life, of promoting the integrity of the medical profession, the ethical integrity of that profession, and promoting respect for life more generally. This is what we, in the context of public bioethics, sometimes call a vital conflict. We have the conflict of incommensurable goods, the great goods that Elizabeth flagged, of course, and the great goods that relate to these other considerations. And it's a very, very difficult question. And framed in the context of this case, it becomes entangled with the question of constitutional interpretation. There's another contending mode of interpretation, which would go as follows, which says the language of the Due Process Clause certainly guarantees due process prior to the state's deprivation of life, liberty, or property. But in 1868, abortion was illegal in almost every state. And the very states that ratified the 14th Amendment, who were deeply committed to eliminating these badges and incidents of slavery and the terrible, terrible scars on our nation for that wickedness that we perpetrated for 100, since the founding up until the enactment of the fighting the Civil War and the embrace of the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments in 1868. Abortion was, I think it's fair to say they drew a distinction between abortion and these other issues, because as I say, no one in 1868 thought that the Due Process Clause forbade states from extending protection to the lives of unborn children. In fact, the very states that ratified the 14th Amendment shortly thereafter, in Ohio, for example, embraced a very strict law on abortion, stricter than the one that had previously existed.
I want to sit for a moment with the implications of the idea that what states allowed in 1868 should be a determining factor in what we allow now. Think of what that would mean. Fortunately, the Supreme Court has explicitly rejected that idea in both Casey, the decision that reaffirmed Roe and protected the right to choose, and also in important cases like Loving versus Virginia, which struck down laws that prohibited couples of different races from marrying each other, something that certainly was also allowed by states at the time of the drafting of the 14th Amendment.
I certainly would never suggest that the practices, including the discriminatory practices of states in 1868, should be frozen in amber and recapitulated under a theory of constitutional interpretation. What I would say, though, is that the practices reflect the original public meaning of the words themselves. And it wasn't until Roe v. Wade that any Supreme Court justice seriously suggested that there was a right to abortion. The position that that in response to and in opposition to the mode of interpretation that Elizabeth sketched out would be one that says that, in fact, yes, you even have judges like Henry Friendly on the Second Circuit, who's an iconic liberal and progressive judge, who said, yeah, there's a right to privacy. And yeah, the right to privacy even includes things about reproductive decision making involving contraception, as in Griswold. But it doesn't extend to the right to terminate a pregnancy, because a pregnancy involves countervailing goods of the prenatal life that is intentionally destroyed.
The 14th Amendment has proved a powerful tool for expanding the basic rights of American citizenship. Now, earlier this year, Netflix released a series exploring the long struggle to realize the aspiration of American equality. Hosted by Will Smith, Amend is a 6-series deep dive on the 14th Amendment.
If you're born in the United States, you're a citizen. Pretty simple, right? And under the law, everyone in America gets this thing called equal protection. That means we all have the same rights and the same legal protection.
Now, since Will Smith was not available to talk us through the implications of the 14th Amendment for reproductive rights, we turn to legal superstars Carter Sneed, professor of law at Notre Dame, and Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center.
I really have to push back on the idea that the Constitution says nothing about the right to choose an abortion. it's not just a question of privacy. It's a question of the entire Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which protects against state infringement the privileges or immunities of equal citizens. It protects liberty from state infringement. It protects equality. It enshrines the equal protection of the laws. Now, the right to privacy is included in a lot of that. Equal protection is part of the text of the 14th Amendment. This isn't something that's an implication. It's directly rooted in the text of the Constitution. And when you look at the purposes behind those words, if you read the legislative history, the drafting history, the statements of people like Senator Jacob Howard, Senator Thaddeus Stevens, the people who wrote these words, it is clear that they intended to protect the right to bodily integrity and the rights, and they talked about this extensively, the ways in which it was denied to enslaved people the right to choose whether and when and with whom to have a family. Now, just like the right to speech, the right to free speech protected in the words of the Constitution also includes the right not to speak. The right to decide whether and when and with whom to have a child also includes the right to decide not to have that child. And the reason why I think it's important not to just dismiss this constitutional text in history. One, it's how judges decide cases, so it's important in that respect. I think it is a powerful reminder to us as Americans that when we faced this question of what does it mean to be a free person, what does it mean to be an equal person, and how are we going to protect that in the Constitution, we made the choice to broadly protect liberty and equality and the ability to come as equal citizens into the public square. And included in that was this idea that in order to do that, we must be able to make decisions about our own bodies and about our own destinies, to chart our own course as part of what it means to be an equal participant in society. And that is an important moment in history that I think has been overlooked in a lot of this debate. And it's important because it shows that this question of being able to control these decisions oneself is inherent in what it means to be free.
Yes, of course, whatever we can do to help advance the good that we're talking about in terms of the equal citizenship of women, their equal participation in the social and economic life of the nation, we should do. The question is, the question of abortion presents a question of, is this something, is this mechanism, the mechanism of abortion, something that first of all, the Constitution creates a right to for the purpose of realizing those goods, or is the question of abortion presenting a mechanism of realizing these goods that creates a conflict between those goods themselves and what the mechanism entails, namely the intentional destruction of life, prenatal life? That's the question, right? So, yeah, one could readily agree that the 14th Amendment's structure, logic, et cetera, means to secure the equal citizenship of women, means to advance all the goods that Elizabeth has so eloquently described, but also say that the question of abortion creates a distinctive problem in that the means of trying to secure those goods involves a practice that involves a kind of intentional killing of another being. And so that's the problem. That's why people disagree. I mean, I can only speak for myself, but if we were simply saying, should we do everything we can consistent with, you know, to promote women's equality, equal citizenship, equal status, I would say, of course, that's right. Yes, absolutely we should. And then if you say, but should that include the intentional killing of innocent beings, I would say, well, no, I would stop there. I would say that's in fact not something we should do, but that's a policy conversation that I think we should be able to have amongst ourselves. And I don't think the Constitution settles that particular, very specific, very difficult conflict.
The other side would say that the core problem here is that the court has been forced by the position you're taking and by the cases to pick sides on the most contentious social debate in American life, and to do so in a situation where they say that the Constitution is neutral on the question of abortion, the text in history, that the Constitution's neither pro-life nor pro-choice on the question of abortion. And they would say, therefore, it should be left to the people, to the states, or to Congress.
Counsel, there's so much that's not in the Constitution, including the fact that we have the last word, Marbury versus Madison. There is not anything in the Constitution that says that the court, the Supreme Court, is the last word on what the Constitution means. It's totally novel at that time. And yet, what the court did was reason from the structure of the Constitution that that's what was intended. And here in Casey and in Roe, the court said there is inherent in our structure that there are certain personal decisions that belong to individuals and the states can't intrude on them.
Justice Brett Kavanaugh and Justice Sonia Sotomayor during Wednesday's oral arguments at the Supreme Court. Now we're picking up on our conversation with Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, and Carter Sneed, professor of law at Notre Dame.
It seems to me that it's impossible to talk about this issue as a constitutional matter, as a policy matter, without describing the conflict of interests that instantiate this problem, right? The very deep and important issues of equal stature for women and the right to plan their own future, to pursue their own future without unjust and unfair encumbrances imposed by the state. But on the, as I say, on the other side, we have this countervailing, and it is a state interest, but the state interest is focused on protecting prenatal human life and engendering respect for prenatal human life. So it's not merely the state's interest in an abstract sense, it's the state interest in the prenatal life that is destroyed in an abortion. And so the problem is, obviously, abortion is such a sui generis issue. The question is, does the Constitution, in making it possible for us and in protecting us in our equal citizenship stature, does it include the mechanism of abortion as the means to that end? And I think that's the fundamental disagreement. And I think those who, my own view and the views perhaps of some of the justices, who knows, we'll find out, is that the Constitution itself does not include abortion among the many important tools that we have at our disposal to realize our equal citizenship stature.
The liberty and equality that is protected in the 14th Amendment is the liberty and equality of that pregnant person. And that's where the right to access abortion is key. Now, what the court is trying to do is to say, okay, recognizing that there's a state interest to some extent in the unborn life, in the medical profession, the law has not, despite some suggestions by Justices Kavanaugh, and I think I heard it from Justice Barrett as well, the suggestion that you're weighing a fetal personhood right versus the pregnant person's right, the law has not actually articulated it yet in that way. There are probably people who would like to see it go in that direction, but that's not actually the way that it works right now. And so centering the person who is pregnant and thinking about the way in which their equality and liberty is necessarily impinged by a forced pregnancy, by not being able to make this decision, I think is really important. And I think it also focuses us on the consequences of this decision. Because if we end up with a patchwork of liberty, which is the way that abortion access would work in this country if Roe is struck down, right now Roe protects nationally a right to choose abortion before viability, which is generally about 20 to 24 weeks, there will be states that still protect that right. There will be many states like Mississippi and other states that have trigger laws on the books that will restrict abortion as soon as Roe is overturned. And that's why the Constitution took some of the most important rights and liberties away from state political decision-making and enshrined them in the Constitution. So we didn't have a patchwork of liberty. So our constitutional freedoms and liberty did not depend on the states in which we live, our zip codes, how much money we have, or our ability to travel out of state. And that, I think, is something that should be centered, not just when we're talking about the constitutional right and interpretation, but in talking about the real world lived consequences.
Our thanks to Carter Sneed, professor of law at Notre Dame, and to Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center. On Wednesday, Georgia Democrat Stacey Abrams announced via Twitter that she would once again seek the office of the governor of Georgia.
Because opportunity and success in Georgia shouldn't be determined by your zip code, background, or access to power.
In her first run in 2018, Abrams narrowly lost to the current governor, Brian Kemp, by 55,000 votes. I mean, it's an election that drew almost 4 million ballots. And she will likely face him again in the 2022 midterm elections if Kemp wins the Republican nomination in the spring. Now, Abrams is widely credited for registering thousands of new young voters and voters of color, helping Joe Biden win the state in the 2020 presidential election, turning Georgia blue in a presidential election for the first time since 1992, and contributing to Democrats capturing the Senate with the runoff elections of Georgia Democrats Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff. With the upcoming midterm elections, all eyes will be on Georgia once again. But the political landscape has changed a bit since 2018. So what will this mean for Abrams' campaign? Joining me now is Delilah Ago-Otohili, who is field director for Stacey Abrams' 2018 gubernatorial campaign and executive director of the Texas Future Project. Welcome to the show, Delilah.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
All right, let's start with just simply with the announcement. Do you have a strong sense of the motivation that Abrams has for running again?
Yeah, you know, I think it's clear that she's really just running to finish what she started so long ago, well before 2018, something that obviously she came close to finishing in 2018. And this is what she's been working towards with all that she's been doing for the people of Georgia these last 3 years since that election, from the work to expanding voting rights to increasing access to COVID-19 vaccines. She's really been gearing up for this race. And I think, you know, it's clear that she's running to be the leader that Georgians need and will be focused on expanding access to healthcare, making sure folks have access to jobs and quality education. So she really just wants to step up for her state, for Georgia.
I mean, one of the key insights that's come out of Abrams' work, not only in terms of running the campaign, but certainly in the organizations that she stood up both before and after the 2018 gubernatorial race, has been this insight of getting registered, engaged, and mobilized all of these Georgians who were simply not part of the electoral system. That has certainly changed the political landscape, but at the same time, there are also now new voting restrictions in Georgia. I'm wondering, as she's kind of looking at the calculus, she's good at the math, right? Kind of looking at those numbers between sort of the new folks brought in, but also the realities of restrictions, is it going to be a harder race, less on the like actual insights of the race, but more on just like who's even available and able to vote?
That's a great question. I think that the restrictions don't really change the work that has to be done to make sure that folks know about elections and turn out for elections and take part in the electoral process. So every get out the vote effort campaign is really just about meeting voters where they are. So regardless of the new restrictions, that tedious work still has to happen. And, you know, I think the 2022 election will not be the first time we're working against voter suppression or new restrictions with voting laws. But I do think that we'll probably see more emphasis on voter education, probably some work around alleviating any like hesitancy around some of the new barriers, particularly in regards to vote by mail. And I also think we'll probably see more robust election protection programs that start doing outreach earlier so that folks know that they have options and folks to call if there are ever problems at the polls. So the new laws definitely bring new challenges that we'll have to work around, but I think that the work will still look the same.
Although this is likely to be a rematch between Kemp and Abrams, there's also some real differences in how both Kemp and Abrams are received within their national party at this point. We have Trump saying he's not going to back Kemp, so maybe Kemp won't even win the Republican nomination. But I'm also wondering if Abrams has a new kind of position within the Democratic Party, given her role in delivering Georgia to Biden and to the Democrats in this past election season, and if that might actually lead to more resources from the National Party.
You know, Stacey's profile today is definitely not what it was when she was running for governor in 2018. And the power and influence she has today looks a lot different. I do think that that will change the amount of resources that come in for 2022, whether that's from the National Party, whether that's from grassroots supporters, but this elevated profile, right, just provides the opportunity for more resources to run bigger, more robust campaigns to reach all the voters across the state.
As field director back in 2018, I'm just wondering, it's one thing to have this sort of 1,000-foot view of how Abrams is received. I was recently with her at an event in North Carolina, and to see sort of, you know, how North Carolinians, who, to be honest, at an event like that are probably mostly Democrats, you know, mostly supporters. These are folks who like, paid a little bit of money to come out and see her speak. But I'm wondering, as field directors, you all are knocking on doors of ordinary Georgians across the state. What kinds of things people say about Stacey Abrams? How is she seen and understood in the state?
Yeah, people love Stacey in Georgia. I remember, Melissa, actually once I took a trip somewhere in the middle of the campaign, came back, grabbed an Uber from the airport. And, you know, the Uber driver was asking me what I do for a living. I said, I work in politics. I always try to avoid that conversation until they probe a little bit more. And said I was working for, you know, a candidate running for governor. And this Uber driver goes on to tell me about how he's never voted before. He's learned about Stacey. He's seen Stacey, whether on TV or at an event. And he has to vote for Stacey because he believes in Stacey and believes in what she'll do for the state. And I think that Stacey just has this ability to connect with voters in this authentic way about things that impact their lives on a daily basis in a way that a lot of politicians don't. So knocking on doors, texting voters, calling voters, the reception is very positive. And folks love Stacey in Georgia just as much as we do across the country.
Your point about like, I try to avoid telling people I work in politics. I'm the same way. If I tell people what I do, I'm like, oh, you know, I'm a school teacher, you know, or college professor. If they ask what I teach, I'm like, oh, it's a social science, right? I just don't even want to say the word politics because it can lead to so many tough conversations. And I guess I want to delve into that just to say I'm consistently surprised by Abrams' willingness to engage in really tough conversations across very broad divisions. And I'm wondering if that is part of, you know, what we might think of as her superpower in the context of Georgia, that she's not just talking, you know, she's not just singing to the choir or preaching to the choir, but willing to have some tough conversations with folks who might not seem like they'd ever be on her side.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think she has those tough conversations. I think she will talk about some of the issues folks don't want to talk about. I think if we look back to the 2018 election, her message around her own struggles with student loan debt or her own struggles with folks in her family, she doesn't hide that, right? And that's the thing, like lots of folks, when she talks about it, because these are her lived experiences, as you know, it's so relatable. And I think a lot of times when we think about elected official, we don't think of them going through the same things that we've gone through, right? Or coming from a family like ours, or struggling with student loan debt or whatnot. So I think that just telling her story and telling everything that she's dealing with just gives folks another thing to connect with her on in a real way.
Absolutely. Dalila Agoa-Otohili is the field director for Stacey Abrams' 2018 gubernatorial campaign. And Dalila is now the executive director of the Texas Future Project. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. Thanks again for having me.
In March, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio created the Racial Justice Commission. The purpose of the commission is to examine structural inequities and to propose ballot initiatives that can address structural racism in the city. The commission is empowered to use the power of charter revision, which means they can propose changes to the city's constitution. Last month, they released their first report, identifying six patterns of inequity facing New Yorkers. I spoke with two members of the commission.
My name is Yesenia Mata. I am a commissioner with the Racial Justice Commission.
My name is Jennifer Jones Austin, commissioner and chair of the New York City Racial Justice Commission.
And Yesenia told me how they spoke with local communities to develop their recent report.
The first report is a culmination of a comprehensive citywide public input process. In every borough, we held in-person sessions, virtual sessions, and there was a process for public comment online. So with this, we are asking the community to work very closely with the commission so we can change any sort of structural racism through the charter revision.
Yesenia, say a little bit more about how community was engaged, sort of at various stages of the process. What did it mean to get community together as part of this?
The immigrant community is often forgotten or left out of these conversations. And it was very interesting to see how the commission was also taking into account language, accessibility was taken into account, interpretation was taken into account, all types of backgrounds of the communities. So it was public hearings, it was through virtual Zooms, it was through public online input, it was just constant public input and all types of levels that made made this more accessible to the communities. Despite if there was a technology barrier, despite it was a language barrier, the commission ensured that we can be accessible to the communities' inputs.
I may just add, we also centered on making sure that the conversations with community members were just that, conversations, that we were not talking at the community, but rather we were hearing from the community and then engaging with them about the issues that they were presenting to us. So it wasn't let's show up in Staten Island or let's come to the Bronx, let's sit in Harlem and tell you what we think will bring about greater equity and end racism. You tell us what you experience on a daily basis. You tell us what your children experience. You tell us, what challenges you. And you also, we want to hear from you what you think would make the difference. So it really wasn't us talking at community, which is what often happens. And that's part of this racist structure in society. It was rather them talking to us.
So tell me, Jennifer, in part, what you found in these conversations, in these engagements where community was having the capacity to, in part, set the agenda. What are the initial reports showing?
Well, first and foremost, what the community was very clear about is that, we often center on racism as tied to policing. And we know that racism, the criminalization of poverty and of race is a constant in this society. We know that's part of the system, right? The system of racism and capitalism and militarism all working in concert to continually oppress people of color. So they talked to us about policing, but they went beyond policing. They understand that racism pervades every pillar of our society, education, healthcare, housing, what is happening in their communities with respect to parks and recreation? Who gets to decide whether or not they have hospitals or, whether they have overabundance of, certain types of facilities that, people in more affluent and predominantly white communities do not want? They helped us to appreciate that they understand racism is not just a policing issue, but it's in every pillar. They talked about inequity in work, in the opportunity to, earn fair and living wages to advance. They talked about how the ever-growing wealth divide keeps them from getting ahead. They talked about inequities in access to basic goods and services, quality goods and services that would bring about greater, economic, social, emotional well-being. Being deprived of quality education, healthcare, housing. They talked about the, over-criminalization of our communities, and the marginalization of our communities. And they talked again about, they talked about not being a part of decision-making.
One of the things I like about what you're saying, Jennifer, is this sense that, communities can already identify the problems, right? They already know, what challenges are facing them. But Yesenia, sometimes communities don't know how all of the inside processes of government and bureaucracy work, right? So folks may even know not only the problems, but the solutions they'd like to see. I'm wondering how this process for communities has maybe also just been kind of like a politics 101 class for how city government works.
The community organized, the community at times know the solutions that they need, or they at times need support on how to get either connections with the city or how to go about their final solution when it comes to organizing, but there's never that support, right? So what happened with this commission, which was very interesting, I think how Jennifer touched up on, was that we were there to listen. And when we listened, And they would tell us that they needed support. Let's just say they needed more information about this topic. The commissioners, we did provide that information to them. It's a way to help them with their organizing, because organizing can only go so far. It also requires to work with the city. It also requires to work either with elected officials. It also requires to work with commissioners, right? And I think that was what was beautiful with the commission itself, that we were helping organizers as they were telling us what was it that they needed or what is it that they hoped to see.
If I may just add that one of the things that we did see, and Yesenia touched upon this, and we heard, I should say, is that community members, sometimes they knew what they needed, but they did not necessarily speak about it in like structural law terms. You know, I need a job that pays me a decent wage. I need an opportunity to advance in my job, and I feel like, you know, I keep being held back. That's what we would hear. We'd hear, you know, the Black women in this city government agency, you know, are denied promotions. We need to have an opportunity to be promoted. We need to be seen. So they would speak to us about what they needed sometime, but they wouldn't necessarily translate that into, here's the structural, you know, the underpinning structural law that needs to be addressed. And it is our responsibility as commission members to hear what they're saying, to hear the struggle, to hear, you know, like, you know, what is needed, but then to figure out what is what impedes that from happening when you look at the charter. What does the charter say about fair and livable wages? What does the charter say about real access to opportunity? What can we do about that by changing structural laws?
So talk to me about these six patterns of inequity that are operating as barriers for people of color in the city.
We heard about, you know, lack of access to quality goods and services. We heard about an inequity in work advancement and wealth building, the overcriminalization of communities of color and people of color, inequity in representation and decision making. And we also heard about, you know, good things being done, but there never being any follow-up. So we're looking at creating a preamble in the city's charter. What are the basics that every resident of New York should be able to expect? We want to be actionable. So we're going to, you know, look at establishing an Office of Racial Equity that is required to center on the anti-marginalization through agency policies and practices of people of color, that looks at how do we establish a true cost of living in New York City. We know good and well that the poverty level is not a true measure of what it costs for people to live. So we're looking at putting in place something like a true cost of living that the city then has to use as a measure for what it costs for people to live and what we need by way of wages and income supports. And then we want to be accountable. So we're looking at how do we establish within the charter a stand up structures like a commission that is going to hold the city accountable for developing racial equity plans and then implementing them, you know, putting in place racial equity, racial and gender equity impact analyses, using data, disaggregated data, to see how people are really faring and looking at their agencies and making the reforms that are necessary. Aspirational, actionable, and accountable.
Yesenia, I'm wondering, let me just kind of come to you on the aspirational. What are you hoping will be different 5 years from now, 10 years from now in the city of New York as a result of this work that you've been involved with?
I was able to see from the very beginning how opportunities were taken from both of my parents because they were undocumented. I saw how language also was a barrier for them. I just saw many opportunities that just were taken away from my parents and close relatives and friends. And I always wanted to see change. I wanted to see equality. I wanted to see equity. I wanted to see just everyone thrive, right? It didn't matter their religion, their background, their status. And I understood that at very early on, once I started organizing, that change will not just happen one day to the next, right? It's going to take time. But because of the organizing that we've done as a community, look where we are now. We now have the first ever racial justice commission. I believe there's still more organizing to be done, but this is the beginning. And I do see us in 5 years from now making more progress than where we are now. I do see this, especially this Racial Justice Commission being a platform, a beginning of new things that are going to happen. So what I do hope to see is that this is used as a vehicle for further organizing. I really love how Jennifer said, like, a lot of the time, us organizers are on the ground, are marching, protesting, are holding meetings. However, we don't have the support when it comes to implementing the law. So someone help us navigate the legal system. Someone help us navigate the financial system, right? So I hope that the Racial Justice Commission is the vehicle to help organizers in the community move forward agendas that they need to better their community and in my community, because I do live in a community in the Latino immigrant community. So I do hope that we are able to use this vehicle to further the rights for our communities.
And Jennifer, I'll just come to you finally on that last aspirational question as well. What is it? What is your great aspiration? What do you hope will change? What will look different in New York City, say, in 5 or 10 years?
In 5 years, my fervent hope, my prayer, is that community has a greater voice, that they feel empowered, that they see that there is a law that says that they have a right to demand more for themselves, and that government has to be accountable in providing more. That that they have, through the changes that are put forward, the opportunity to say, you know, the data here shows that you are discriminating against us. The equity plan here shows that, you know, the policies and the practices, the programs that you put in place, don't go far enough to address and redress all of the harms that have been visited upon Black communities, indigenous persons, other people of color for centuries. I'm really hoping, praying, believing that people develop greater voices through this, and that they feel that there is a law to which they can turn, a structure that says that they have every right to demand more of this government when government is not providing what it should equitably.
Jennifer Jones Austin and Yesenia Mata of the New York City Racial Justice Commission, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, another politics show is wrapped with a bow, y'all. Thanks for tuning in. Now, remember, we always want to hear from you. Your show ideas, your suggestions, your comments. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And before I go, let me give my team a quick shout out. Our senior producer is Ethan Oberman. Our producers are Meg Dalton, Katarina Barton, Deborah Goldstein, and Joseph Jedian. Shanta Covington is our planning editor. Zachary Bynum is our digital editor. Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer. Jake Howitt is our director. Milton Ruiz and Sham Sundra also helped out on the board this week. Jackie Martin is line producer supreme. David Gable is our administrative assistant. And Mary Croak is our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.